From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
This is a movie that most people in America probably haven't heard of, but for what it's worth, most people in Hollywood probably have.
Remember Wet Hot American Summer? Maybe not. The 2001 spoof set in a New England summer camp was a box office flop, but it had an amazing cast of future stars, and over time it acquired a cult following. Now director David Wayne tells us how he reunited Paul Rudd, Amy Poehler, Elizabeth Banks, Bradley Cooper, and more for the new Netflix prequel, Wet Hot American Summer, First Day of Camp. But first on the news banter, The Terminator. Will he be back? And ESPN sheds talent. Stay tuned. It's The Business from KCRW. I'm joined by my partner in banter, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
This past week, Universal Pictures surprised no one by announcing that Jurassic World 2 will happen, a sequel. They actually named a date in June of 2018. The Jurassic Park reboot, Jurassic World, this summer just has mopped up, has moved into being the number three grosser of all time, which is kind of astonishing when you think about it. Everything came together for this reboot.
Yeah, this was a franchise that was essentially dead. I mean, they had done two sequels to Jurassic Park. They had diminishing returns on both of them. Universal just kind of let it lie low. They made some theme park rides. And then all of a sudden, Spielberg gets interested again and says, let's do it. They get a director whose last movie was made for $750,000.
That's Colin Trevorrow with a movie called Safety Not Guaranteed.
Right. And, you know, $750,000 is probably not even his box office bonus on this movie.
You're right. And we've seen, you know, Universal did this with Fast and Furious a few years ago. It looked like it had sort of died and it came back to life. But it doesn't always work. You know, it has to be done just right. As David Ellison has found, he has a company called Skydance Productions. He's the son of Larry Ellison, so he's a very young billionaire. He's been in Hollywood for a few years now. He teamed up with Paramount and participated in some big Paramount movies, like the Mission Impossible franchise. This was a baby of his. He wanted to restart Terminator, and he was so confident. He said he was going to do three. He dated three movies into the future. And the first one came out, and meh.
Right. It hasn't even gotten to $100 million in the U.S. It's doing better overseas, where Arnold is perceived as a bigger star. It hasn't opened in China yet, so it could still eke out $400 million around that. But in this day and age of franchise summer movies, that's just not good enough, especially when you spend upwards of $165 million to make the movie.
And a lot to market it, too. Yeah. I mean, this is what we could call a bubble movie. It's sort of may just get to the point where they'll make another one. And there are movies like that that don't do tremendous numbers. But if you can make another one for a price, and I'm thinking of the most recent Godzilla or Jack Reacher with Tom Cruise or Pacific Rim, the Guillermo del Toro movie, they all did okay, not great, but the decision has been made. It's worth, at a price, making another one.
Right. And I think that's a very difficult calculus that's being done at studios right now. They all want franchises. They're all under tremendous pressure to have franchises. And yet the audience doesn't necessarily agree that this is a franchise. And I think that's what's going on with Terminator right now. The audience just kind of saw it and was like, eh, not really for me. And the core audience of younger males just did not show up for this movie. And I know Paramount was very surprised about that.
Yeah, that is not a good thing. And speaking of that core audience, we are to presume that Bill Simmons, who is now leaving ESPN and has, I don't know, some 2 million Twitter followers, he's a prolific talent, one of a batch of talents lately leaving ESPN and going to make a big deal with HBO.
Right. Simmons is inarguably the biggest sports personality out there right now. And the fact that he's leaving ESPN, the fact that he was pushed out of ESPN really says something about what's going on there. And I think with Keith Olbermann and with another radio host there, Colin Cowherd, who just decided to leave ESPN for Fox Sports, there's a little bit of a brain drain going on at ESPN. And I think the interesting thing is the economics behind that.
Yeah, they're losing subscribers as people unbundle. And a lot of people like me have been complaining about having all these ESPN channels rammed down their throats by cable companies. And that's unwinding right now.
Well, ESPN has been the darling of the cable industry. Its subscriber fees are well above any other channel. It has used that money to bid up the price of sports rights over the past decade to the point where the price of carrying the NFL and Major League Baseball and college sports is so expensive that the bottom line there, it's not adding up. Of all the Disney divisions last quarter, ESPN, which is part of the Disney Media Networks, Disney Media Networks was the only one that was down in profits. And Bob Iger, the CEO of Disney, blamed ESPN and the high cost of sports rights. So it's an interesting thing. They're the most powerful outlet in cable, yet they're being forced to trim costs because of the price of their programming.
Yeah, and Bill Simmons, it's also worth noting, had bagged on the NFL commissioner, Roger Goodell, and that did not seem to go over too well with ESPN either. So between him and Keith Olbermann, you know, we're seeing a lot of sort of noisy personalities ushered out.
Right. I mean, ESPN maintains that Olbermann is out because of economics and his show was not doing the ratings that it wanted. And it also claims that it tried to keep Colin Cowherd. But the trend here is clear that ESPN is saying that it's not willing to pony up and keep these people that are very expensive when they are under these financial considerations.
And meanwhile, HBO, as it gets into the streaming world, is looking to fill up a lot of different verticals. And, you know, with a guy like Simmons, who's prolific.
Absolutely. This is a big win for HBO because what their priority is right now is this HBO Now service, which you can now get HBO over the internet without subscribing to cable. And the goal of HBO right now is to have additional content on HBO Now that can live there and be an additional lure for people to go there. Simmons fits right into that. In addition to a weekly talk show that he'll have, he's going to be expected to produce content for HBO Now, whether that's a podcast or video content or whatever it is, we don't know yet. That's going to be a lure for younger viewers to go to HBO Now and subscribe.
And just on a closing note, a bunch of stars, Jerry Seinfeld, David Letterman, have asked for their blurbs endorsing Mark Whitaker's biography of Bill Cosby to be removed. The book is disgraced because it did not explore these rape allegations that have been in the news so much. And the publisher, Simon & Schuster, has also said no paperback, no future editions of that book.
I mean, that book is dead. And I don't know what else you say about the Cosby situation, but it just keeps getting worse and worse.
Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter.
Hey, you guys. Everybody focus up, okay? All eyes here. I would like to announce that Ben and I are planning to produce a musical number from Godspell for the talent show tonight. I'm sorry, Ben is producing. I'm directing / choreographing.
And I'm only speaking from personal experience, but if you can't carry a tune, don't come into the audition environment and waste our time. For serious, okay?
Okay, and bring a lot of movement clothes.
That's Amy Poehler and Bradley Cooper playing summer camp theater instructors Susie and Ben in the 2001 spoof Wet Hot American Summer. Poehler and Cooper were part of what turned out to be an impressive lineup of staff getting through the last day of summer camp at Camp Firewood in 1981. Also in the cast were Paul Rudd, David Hyde Pierce, Elizabeth Banks, Chris Maloney, and more. Critics had no love for Wet Hot American Summer when it had its very limited theatrical release 14 years ago, but over time the movie has become legend in the comedy world, especially as many of its cast members went on to big careers. Now, David Wayne, who directed the film and co-wrote it with his comedy partner, Michael Showalter, has pulled off the ultimate coup. He's reunited the entire cast for a Wet Hot American Summer series on Netflix and tossed in a bunch of new players, including Jon Hamm, Jason Schwartzman, and Kristen Wiig.
I'll be on the boat rowing crew. If we can find a coxswain.
Part of the joke is that almost all the cast members are in their 40s, but they're still playing teens in the 8 episodes that will start streaming on July 31st. As in the original movie, the series is set in 1981. It follows the campers and counselors on the first day of camp, filling in their origin stories. H. John Benjamin plays camp leader Mitch. Paul Rudd reprises his role as a nasty piece of work named Andy.
Some of you were campers last year, but now you're all 16 or 17 years old. These are some things that will not happen here this summer. No relations between campers and counselors. This includes dry humping, necking, wet humping, wheelbarrowing, saltwater taffying. You were supposed to be here a week ago.
Whatever. Smells weird. Who beefed?
Wayne told us that when he and Michael Showalter wrote the original Wet Hot American Summer movie, they had experience in sketch comedy and television, but not in film, which may explain the movie's quirkiness.
I don't know that it comes from any particular canon or antecedent, which is maybe what we were going for on some level, but me and Michael Showalter loved movies like Animal House and Caddyshack and those classic comedies from our generation. But we also had a different, more absurdist bent to the humor that we liked to do on our TV show, The State, which we had done before that on MTV. And so our concept for this movie was to take something that was a real experience that we both had a lot to feel about, which was summer camp, and then mix it with our cuckoo sense of humor and put all our friends in it. That was sort of the initial idea behind Wet Hot American Summer, the movie.
Well, as you say, a good portion of the cast came from The State, the sketch comedy show that you guys, you and Michael Showalter did, who he also co-wrote the film. And then Michael Ian Black, a bunch of people came from that group. I mean, were those the first people you put into the original film?
Yeah, pretty much. We wrote it and then looked at the characters and said, who among the people we love, including our fellow members of our group, The State, makes sense for it? And in addition, we knew that we wanted a mix of star power in there, and Janine Garofalo was the most famous person we knew, and we asked her to do it, and she was sort of the engine that helped get it financed eventually 3 years later.
You have this absurdly, these people who've come on, like Bradley Cooper and Amy Poehler, who become these gigantic stars. I don't know that they'd done a movie when you cast them in this thing.
I believe it was Bradley Cooper's first job, period. And it was also Elizabeth Banks as well.
They just auditioned. How did you come across Bradley Cooper? You just open auditions?
Yeah, our casting director, Susie Ferris, brought in young people that were around New York and auditioning for stuff, and they both walked in the door, and we said, yeah, hello.
Did you say, someday this guy is going to be a gigantic A-list?
I didn't know specifically, but I definitely could tell that Bradley Cooper was going to play an American Sniper. That I could tell.
You knew that right away. Well, you have Ant-Man in the movie. Paul Rudd is in your movie.
Well, this was, I think it was before he did Ant-Man, but I'd have to look it up.
But in that original troupe, he was supposed to be like the hot guy, right?
Well, yeah, he was the hot,
he was the hot douchey guy.
Rebel douche guy,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and again, were these open calls? Just like Paul Rudd, he seems like
Paul Rudd was a known entity at the time. He had done Clueless, had done 200 Cigarettes. I think he had done Cider House Rules around the same time. Yeah, he was another sort of slight name-ish.
Yeah. So one of the weirdest ones to me is definitely Christopher Maloney, because, you know, he's done a lot of very intense, he plays brooding guy more than funny guy now. And yet there he is, being brooding but funny.
He actually also, even though he was very well known at the time, relatively speaking, he came in and read for us too and gave this bizarre performance that we just threw it out the papers. We're just like, yeah, oh God, how could we ever say no to this crazy force of nature that just walked in the room?
Now, I know you did mention that you knew Bradley Cooper would someday be the American Sniper, but I wonder, did you really get it that you had assembled that kind of caliber of talent? And it's so random. Some of these people became huge and some of them not so much.
Yeah, I mean, we knew it was a great group. The core of the cast were people we knew and worked with all the time. And then these other new people we met, I knew they were amazing. Of course, you could never predict exactly how big they would get, but I'm certainly not surprised.
So I've heard that you told the people who at the camp where you initially shot that it was going to be a PG romp, and then it turned out to be not that, and they were kind of surprised.
Well, it was more, I would say it was more that my memory of it anyway is that we just very selective about what we did tell them.
And right.
And I do think we gave them a whitewashed script where we toned down a lot. I know we prepared one also, yeah, for all the locations or what, you know, all the vendors, anyone that was in the Pennsylvania area where we were shooting that needed to, you know, wanted to know what we were up to. Of course, in subsequent years, I just never even bothered it. I never offer up a script, but we just, we didn't want to take any chances. Yeah. So we tried not to tell anybody what we were really doing. particularly the parents of the young children that were extras.
That's my next question, actually. I was thinking, what did you tell those parents? Because the kids are, I'm assuming they're in the room when some of this really not PG behavior goes on.
The parents were had such a good time because they were from this area in Pennsylvania. It's not like a lot of film productions came through town, and they would drive a long way to get there every morning and all hang out with each other. And it was like a big party for these kids and their parents, and everyone had a good time. But yeah, sometimes we had to strategically, you know, shoot an angle on something where the kid wasn't actually in the shot so we could then do what we had to do.
The kids that were in the movie, did they see the movie after it was finished?
I assume they did. I mean, I hear from them now, and now that we did our Netflix series, I've heard from a lot of the kids who were extras or cast in the movie, and they, yeah, they've all seen it now.
They've seen it now, but in the
I mean,
day,
they weren't,
you don't
by
know.
The way, they weren't like four-year-olds. They were,
no,
you know,
they
the
weren't.
Kids in the movie were preteens and teenagers.
Right. Okay.
I'll tell you this. The summer camp that I actually went to in Maine, that was part of the inspiration for it,
right.
Wanted to show the movie at the camp. But they couldn't because it's just terrible in that way. And so, but I took the time actually to re-edit a totally sanitized version of it just to show at the camp. And then they got the DVD later and their parents were terrified.
Right, of course. So I did hear that you also maybe said that the budget was going to be bigger than it was to sell it to make it sound like a bigger deal.
Oh, I think maybe when it was done and we were trying to sell it at Sundance, we probably tried to tell distributors that we made it for $5 so that they would want to buy it then for $10 or something. That was our strategy. But we actually made it for $1.8 and sold it for like nothing.
So it went to Sundance. Then it, you know, it didn't open and the critics were mean to it, right? I remember reading it had really good screenings at Sundance.
It did have great screenings at Sundance, I thought. And we had 30 members of our cast there and we had an amazing time. And audiences were laughing and cheering, I felt. But afterwards, not even the lowest level distributors showed even a glint of interest. There wasn't even a low offer for it from anyone. And it wasn't until several months later that USA Films was surprised to hear that it was still available and made a ridiculously unfavorable to us offer, which we took.
Which you immediately accepted, right?
Yeah.
It must have been a real thrill of victory, agony of defeat moment where they're getting these cheers at Sundance and then there's radio silence from the people who had the money. You know?
Yeah, and of course, you know, we had our reps there ready to, you know, like ready to field offers and, you know, create bidding wars and make deals,
right.
And like to wait in line, hold on, you know, and nobody came up. So that was interesting. And yes, not a happy time. But then we were truly thrilled that it was just going to come out at all, which it did. It had a so-called theatrical release starting in New York within, I think, one theater or two theaters. And then it eventually sort of very slowly platformed out to maybe 20 cities or something. And it was really flaccid. And it never, I don't think it ever broke the magic $300,000 gross.
Yeah, that would be the definition of blockbuster, right?
Yeah.
So then, I mean, at some point you become aware that it has a life. It lives.
Yeah. After that non-event of the release, then the DVD came out also to no noise whatsoever. But then after that, I guess people just started finding it little by little and passing it around and having a certain sense of ownership over it because it wasn't a movie people had heard of and they were turning their friends onto it. And by 2003, they were doing these midnight screenings in New York and people were dressing up and cheering and having costumes and contests, and it became little by little quite the cult film.
That must have been satisfying after it seemed like nobody loved your baby, and it
is very gratifying, and it continued to go. I mean, it built all the way to today where it keeps getting more and more popular, separate from the Netflix show. It's been this growing monster.
Coming up after a short break, David Wayne tells us how he persuaded everyone in the cast of Wet Hot American Summer to return and how he wound up directing himself in the prequel. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Browse the KCRW store and shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and merchandise. Shop to support KCRW only at kcrw.com/store.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to David Wayne, director and co-writer of the movie Wet Hot American Summer and the new Netflix series Wet Hot American Summer, First Day of Camp. Early in the 2001 film, camp counselors played by Bradley Cooper, Elizabeth Banks, Amy Poehler, Michael Showalter, and Michael Ian Black made an unlikely plan.
Hey, let's all promise that in 10 years from today, we'll meet again, and we'll see what kind of people we've blossomed into.
Yeah!
What time you want to meet?
You mean 10 years from now?
Yeah.
Let's meet in the morning so we can make a day of it.
Okay, so what is it? Is it like 9 or 9:30?
Well, let's say 9. That way we can be here by 9:30.
Well, no, why don't we say 9:30 and then make it your beeswax to be here at 9:30? I mean, we're all going to be in our late 20s by then. I just don't see any reason why we can't be places on time.
And now, actually, 14 years later, you must have not thought there was the smallest chance that you would be getting these people back together again until, I don't know when. When did it start seeming like it could be a thing?
Well, we had always talked about it or just kind of daydreamed about what could we do again, you know, like to reunite the cast. But as you said, it seemed like such a Herculean task to bring all these people back together, even if there was enthusiasm on their part. And then I think at first I was saying, let's not try to do another feature. That's just too much material and it would be so hard and we would never get people together for it. And let's just do like a 5-minute short for YouTube and then that'll be fun, you know. But no, we then got more serious, and I guess just as the years went on and started to really develop material for this prequel, and then we realized we had so much material that if we tried to fit it into an hour and a half, it would be butchering it. And as we looked around, we saw that there's this new medium called a Netflix show, which gave us a much wider space and kind of the perfect delivery system for what we wanted to do, and turned out to be the perfect place to do it.
Was Netflix the only place where you said, you know, Did you have to go do the whole rounds or no?
No, we didn't do any rounds. We pretty much decided this is a Netflix show, and so let's hope Netflix agrees.
I'm trying to figure the logistics of it. You know,
I think we took Wilshire, and then we just went into
Fountain.
Their office, and then we parked in the, it depends on what time of day.
Right. No, I'm just wondering whether you kind of shoot out messages to Bradley Cooper and Paul Rudd and say, you know, when you're not doing Ant-Man or whatever, Pitch Perfect or whatever thing you're doing, if we had a Netflix show, would you be willing?
That's exactly what we did, not with just those guys, with every single member of the cast. The first step we did was we called them all up and said, hey, we have just this general idea to do a prequel as a Netflix series. If that works out, would you be a part of it? And they all said, yeah, if I have time, if and when I am available. And
that's like a Hollywood no, though. Yeah, if I have time, you know, like in other words,
I mean, no one can ever commit to anything, of course, in Hollywood. But they all said, I really would love to do it. You know, just let me know when it's real and we'll see if it can work out.
So, you know, you can tell me who was the big diva that you had to shame into doing it and tell them that everybody else is doing it.
Michael Showalter.
Okay, I knew it.
My partner.
So then you go beyond this crazy thing that you've already put together, and you have John Hamm and John Slattery. I don't know what the fraction is of Mad Men you've got.
Well, we also actually had Rich Sommer from Mad Men as well.
Okay, three elements. And Michael Cera and Josh Charles. I was not expecting that. Were these people just all fans? And Kristen Wiig, you know, or did you say, have you ever seen this movie? Or did they all know what it was and want to do it?
I think they all knew it. I mean, this is a movie that most people in America probably haven't heard of, but for what it's worth, most people in Hollywood probably have. It's a movie that I think certainly people who are interested in comedy probably know at this point. And furthermore, most of the people you just mentioned were, to greater or lesser degrees, people we knew or at least were acquainted with in some way or had crossed paths with at some point over the years. So it was a lot of us just getting in touch and saying, hey, we're doing this prequel, will you come play with us? And they all did.
So you actually created a camp that looks like the same camp that was in the original, and I heard there was some movie magic.
The movie was shot at a real summer camp in Pennsylvania in the spring of the year 2000, and the series was shot on the West Coast in Los Angeles at a ranch in Malibu. And so we copied the structural look and feel of the bunks at the cabins at the original camp and built two of them. And then, yes, through movie magic, we did a lot of clever doubling and angles and adding and using those two buildings in 1,000 different ways. And I do think that you'd never know when you watch it. Part of what we had to our advantage is the fact that, like the movie, it all mostly takes place in one location. And I directed all 8 episodes, and we were able to, therefore, take all the scenes for the entire series and shuffle them as needed so that whenever any particular set of actors was available, we could shoot the scene that they're in.
Ah, you had a lot of flexibility that way, I guess.
A lot of flexibility, and we were able to just on the fly, you know, we would say, this person could be all here at the same time for 4 hours this afternoon. We're like, great, so let's walk over to that corner of the camp and shoot that scene, you know.
Did it change the dynamic on the set that some of these people are so, you know, such major stars at this point?
I have to say, I was happy to see that it didn't. Once people showed up, it was exactly the same. And we're, you know, part of the reason we cast these people in the first place is they're all really nice, sweet, great people that we like to work with. I think that that's an important element to having a happy life is working with people that you like to hang out with. And this particular group of people was just really fun. And it wasn't, there was no star feeling or, you know, nobody showed up with an entourage or anything.
You put yourself in the movie. You play Yaron. You're an Israeli counselor, and you're vying with Michael Showalter's character, Coop, for Lake Bell's favors.
Who is this guy?
That's Yaron. He's the new soccer counselor. He's from Israel.
Yeah, what?
Yaron.
What?
Yaron.
Yaron?
Yaron.
Huh? Wow. Wow.
I'm so happy to meet all of you. In Israel, we have a saying, "Hayim tirtzeh lo kol dati." It means, will you dance with me? And that is how I feel about all of you, men, women, counselors, campers. I want you all to dance with me. So.
The truth is that we had written this character of an Israeli counselor, which I quite liked the character, but it was never my thought to play the role. But in the development of the script, we would read out loud around the writer's room table, and all the writers would just, you know, read all the parts. And I read this Yaron character and did my best recollection of the Israeli accent from the counselors that I remember at my summer camp. And it seemed to go over well enough that I was heavily encouraged to take this role, and I certainly didn't fight it.
So what, I mean, you did the magic trick. You've got these episodes. What's the thinking? Is this the final Wet Hot Summer, or is there more Wet Hot Summer?
Oh, I don't know. I don't think it is. I think we might have thought of it before we embarked on it as like this is a one-time thing, but so far all concerned seem extremely happy with it. And so, as we all know, we won't know anything about the ratings ever.
Right.
So I guess
Netflix does not share.
We'll just see what happens. But I know from a creative point of view, there's a lot more still that we could go into and would be excited to do so.
A lot more wet, hot.
When it first came out, everyone would say, what's your movie that you're doing? And it almost had a subtitle, which was, it's called Wet, Hot American Summer. It's not a porno.
It does sound kind of like that. David Wayne is the director of Wet, Hot American Summer and the new Netflix series, Wet, Hot American Summer, First Day of Camp. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Wet Hot American Summer, First Day of Camp, starts streaming July 31st on Netflix. And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can hear The Business on demand with the KCRW smartphone app and get the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.